The Startup to Scale Up Game Plan is brought to you by Alpina Search, Europe's premier talent search firm, dedicated to helping technology startups and scale-ups recruit high-impact executives. Now over to your host, Gary Riemann.
Amrit Sami is a VC at Mercia's early stage ventures team, investing in life sciences, deep tech, and a B2B SaaS. Amrit has a really interesting perspective on getting a start in the world of VC, as well as startup lessons that many entrepreneurs may find valuable. So I'm looking forward to my first podcast conversation of 2024. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Gary. Hopefully 2024 starts off with a bang.
How did you get started as a venture capitalist?
That's a really good question. So my background was in chemical engineering. For me, I always wanted to kind of commercialize science, and I thought it was a route of on the technical side of things. As an engineer, you spend a lot of your time in premier inns, as I always tell people. I know the menu off by heart, sadly. Alongside that, I did a lot of reading. And so I read what they teach at Harvard Business School and sort of realized, kind of discovered the world of venture capital and realized actually the reasons for why particular science projects or science ideas weren't scaling were actually more on the commercial side. And so for me, it felt like venture capital was the right route to really help commercialize science. With that kind of in mind, it was, I tried to do everything I could to get into venture. I remember I was cold calling about 60 VC funds. Sorry if I've cold called you and you're listening to this show, but it helped me get my cold call skills. About 60 of them all said no, but I still determined as ever. And so I remember I was asking friends and family and kind of got into a world of accelerators, built up my experience helping a lot of early stage founders, just knew it was the career for me. And so cutting the kind of long story, I managed to get an internship at a fund called Simban Capital, doing B2B SaaS investment. And it was a dream come true. I did it for 2.5 years, was supporting on 6 transactions, was on the board of 4 companies, just kind of a great experience. And then recently moved over to Mercia Ventures, where I get to use my 5 years of chemical engineering looking at amazing life science and deep tech companies.
So what do you enjoy so much about VC? Has it lived up to your expectations?
I think initially what I thought I would really enjoy about VC was the transactional side of analyzing companies, analyzing markets. But the most exciting thing about kind of venture is just working with founders and really watching them kind of grow and scale and being on the sidelines, supporting them and doing anything I can to always kind of network hustling, finding that next customer on that next introduction and just being there, being a monolith in this kind of crazy, that it is startups.
And in those early days, since you didn't have the operational experience, you were relatively green to the world of VC, did you suffer from any imposter syndrome?
Oh, hugely. I don't have a background in investment banking. I wasn't a strategy consultant. And all the people you saw, either Harvard MBAs or Stanford MBAs or, you know, did amazing things and exited businesses. But what I came to kind of realize in venture is you're often looking for the outlier. And that means you're often having to think differently. And so if everyone is of a similar background, of a similar skill set, they'll all be looking at the same things. And so really helping to build the conviction in myself that my unique background is very different. But for me, in venture as a whole, that's actually a really positive thing because it helps me look at companies in a very different way and, you know, see greatness where other people won't.
And I think we're going to circle back a bit later on diversity as well in a slightly different context. But what are some of the other key lessons that you've learned over your relatively formative years in venture capital?
Well, I think the saying goes, every day is a school day. You're always learning from it. But for me, I think the kind of really key lessons I've learned is just to back amazing people and kind of great things will happen. I think it's incredibly important to, I think, go from a point of trust and building relationships. Even with early founders, you'd be surprised how small this world is. I remember, again, give an example, I spoke to someone and then someone from Jamaica wanted to reach out to me and look at his company. And I was like, how do you know me? And he goes, well, because X said I should speak to you. And really, there becomes a compounding effect over time where people are now sharing deals and everyone talks. So the way I always think about it is when I go into every meeting is, what would the last 10 people say about me? And so really going into that next meeting of like, I've got a reputation to constantly keep on building and make sure I'm constantly supporting people. I think the second thing is, it's an industry where it takes a long time to generate, you know, huge financial returns or successes in the industry. And so always playing the long-term game. And so really, I always try and help every founder, any person on LinkedIn, perhaps don't do 100% of the time, but really trying to help everyone I can, whether it is, because I was probably in that position as well. And I need to reciprocate because very few people took their time out and really helped and supported me with that. So I believe it's really important to give a sort of the second piece in it. So networking, to build a great reputation, three, always supporting people. The other kind of key bits is, I think, being really honest with yourself and removing the ego of, as I was saying, try and be egoless and be ego of the business and then be ego of yourself as a founder is probably one of the big things I've seen in venture. And we're seeing a lot of great companies fail because of it, but a lot of great companies succeed because they ultimately care about making the business a success. And so what that is often a person who is, you know, the founder of the idea, the great idea, believes they should be the CEO. And that may not necessarily be their skill set. They may be a great CTO, a great operator. And it's finding the people of what your strength is and what ultimately interests you and what you're passionate about. Finding other people who can help and support you with that. And I think that's, you know, incredibly important. For me, it shows a lot of maturity when I look at founders who go, look, I'll be the CEO now, but I'm not probably the CEO for the next couple of years because these aren't where my strengths are. Don't get me wrong, there are people who can learn into their skill set. And just like me, when I got into venture, I think it's also how much time do you have to really learn and make mistakes? Is there a second point of it? I think next point I think really thinking about is always think about how you can always learn from stuff and build up processes from it. So in venture, and I think especially in startups, what you often see is there are these kind of pitchforks moments where do we take decision A or do we take decision B or C, D, and E? And so what happens is I think founders think about it and then they go for A or B. And it's often based on a lot of assumptions. They're not quite sure. They don't know this may work, that may work. There's information to show X, there's information to show Y. And really what I always tell founders is, okay, what micro experiments could you do to test A or test B and learn from it quickly as possible? And so I think coming to that mindset of running these experiments, learning as fast as possible is hugely important. And then lastly, just how tough it is to run a startup and run a business. I think you need a whole village to support you as a CEO. Like you need a great spouse, great loving family, great network to help you get through because it is hugely tough, especially at the pre-seed and seed stages. You see these amazing people who they could probably get millions of pounds working at Google, OpenAI, or that's amazing, a bank. And then yet they want to build a startup and build something really huge and successful thing. And you've got to be able to literally live like a pauper for as long as you can till you get to that next stage. Unless you're, I don't know, OpenAI or one of these amazing AI companies that raise, you know, millions of pounds. But the longer you can give yourself burn rate, the longer to learn about things, to really understand your business, the better foundations and setting yourself up for success. It's that, you know, age old saying of you need to walk before you can run. So those are probably like all the lessons I've sort of learned in venture, which I feel like I could probably keep on going and keep on talking about it and write, but I'll leave that for maybe my book that I may write in 10, 15 years time.
You mentioned micro experiments. Can you give me one or two examples of what you mean by a micro experiment for testing a thesis or testing the market?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Really good question. So one of the things is, especially with B2B SaaS companies and the way I think about venture is kind of tech risk or market risk. And usually you don't want to be in a position where there's high tech risk and high market risk, but B2B SaaS, there's usually really high market risk and relatively low tech risk, kind of offset it. And so you're trying to figure out what's the right go-to-market strategy to figure about it. And that's, you know, spend a lot of my time as a VC thinking about whether it's the right idea or not. And sometimes that can go quite hand in hand with products. So there was, again, a one company and they were thinking about, should we build this product, you know, as a lead generation tool to then upsell these additional products? And it could be a great like like a freemium product, so to speak. And then, so we're thinking about it and you go, well, speak to your first 10 customers. What were the reasons for them to actually wanting to buy your product? Would they be interested in a freemium product? And when it kind of came to it, those first sort of 10 customers I spoke to, they're like, yeah, we wouldn't have really done that. We didn't really want to care about it. We wanted your product because of those features you had on it. And so it kind of came a bit more apparent that this product probably wasn't going to sell. It wasn't going to find the kind of initial right customers, the people who really care about the product. It wasn't going to persuade them. It was more for the mass market, which isn't where they wanted to focus now. And so I think thinking about, you know, speaking to your 10 customers, speaking to your customers on a regular basis on why they wanted to invest and get to know them a bit better, or speaking to friends, speaking to family and building that. So those sort of micro experiments and having to build it and really understand the customer. Two, I think another example is, I think generative AI is another, a good one is some of the kind of portfolio companies I'm looking at and, you know, my own angel investments of, should we build a Gen AI product? Should we not? And so they did a lot of, you know, market research and analyzing, like, look, we've got all these competitors that are doing it and it's going to be table stakes in the upcoming years. And so it's, do we do it now? Do we do it not? And again, same question is like, well, what micro experiment could we do to automate it? Like, could you maybe just use AI for a small portion of your product and that take you a lot less time and see, would you upsell it? Or the customers who said no to you or didn't want to do that, could you reach out to them and offer the AI product and speak to them about that? And would they be interested in it? And so those sorts of things on, you know, instead of having to spend like, you know, years, months, or what have you in it, could you run these really small things of, you know, speaking to the right people, connecting with the right people, and or building a small piece of your product to really understand of whether it makes sense to put all this investment into that, I think is super key.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned support networks or support villages, as you termed it. What do you and your colleagues at Mercia do to help the entrepreneurs you've invested in to build an effective support network?
Hugely important. So I think every investor has their own nuances and different ways of approaching it. And so definitely the way that I go about things and know others within the Mercia brand is, one, sometimes we just like having a check-in every 2-3 weeks, having a WhatsApp group, putting half an hour time and allowing them to really vent. God, this sales didn't work, that didn't work. It's just terrible. 2023 is really tough. Why couldn't it be like 2020 or 2021? So having that time to realize that it's people at the end of the day, it's not a business, and we shouldn't be like whipping them and carrying that. So finding that open space is super important. But alongside that, what I think Mercia, and again, one thing attracted me to it is about 160 odd people, which a VC fund, as well as we do offer debt and private equity, is huge. I mean, within the VC arm as a whole, we're about 60 odd people just covering the UK. What that means is all these amazing people who have got all great networks and all care about startups. And so that compounds quite over time. And often what it meant that is, we can find, you know, a great chairman, we can find, you know, maybe those customers, we can find, help you find that CTO, help you find that head of engineering, or connect you with the right recruitment agencies or with the right fractional people. It just makes their jobs a hell of a lot easier with finding and hiring talent, but then also non-exec chairmen within the organizations. So that's really kind of how Mercia helps with that. But I think as well, as investors, we've got a duty to be a large portion of that village of being an empathetic listener, but also caring the interests of the fund as well, and really helping support them in any way we can.
And just expanding on the ideas of support and teams, what about the challenges for startups building their initial leadership team? What are some of the lessons you've learned from the portfolio companies you've helped? And I'd like to bring the topic of diversity back into this, which we briefly touched upon earlier.
Yeah, it's I think really interesting. So what we're seeing a lot more within venture, and especially in the later stages, is there's been a huge push on ESG, and as well as part of that being DE&I, and as well as for some of LPs mandating what your diversity quotas are. And I think especially at points of exits where the likes of some of these banks or some of these private equity firms really caring about it and making sure there are initiatives in place for these organizations. And so if that's your kind of exit point, you need to really think about that at the really early stages and make sure that's part of your foundational point. And so really what we kind of think about is on, I guess, two fronts is Have you got kind of a fair hiring practice? Have you got the right diversity of, I think personally for me, is diversity of thought. That's what you need, is you need this organized chaos of people challenging one another and saying, no, you're wrong. But, you know, creating that environment to say that you're comfortable, that no, you're wrong, even if they don't have experience on it, and it challenging people and creating an environment where people can challenge one another and but yet can kind of work together and kind of achieve an end goal is one of the most beautiful things about startups, but also one of the most frustrating things about startups, because if it doesn't work, it just crumbles and it will crumble later down the line. But I think having that point where you can communicate with one another about those challenges, it's a great thing. And the challenge with that is often people who are willing to, you know, say you're wrong or that I don't believe in X, Y, and Z are often, you feel comfortable hearing that because they're your friends. But the problem with people being your friends is they may have a similar background to you. They may have the same skill sets. You may have worked with them. And so what you may have is maybe have three product people trying to be a CEO, a COO, and a CTO, and it just doesn't quite work. And so sometimes you need to find people who you haven't met in your previous experiences. You may have to reach out and build that really trusting relationship, who have differing experiences to you and different practices. And so that for me is a really interesting sign, is when you know, a leadership team, they've got someone external from the early onset, and they've been able to build a relationship and able to grow the business. And he provides a completely different set of experiences. They haven't worked together or any sorts, but they've able to find a secure that person through networks, through recruitment agencies or what have you, to really bring in that diversity of thinking, to really challenge thought. Because again, you're working on something 18 hours a day, maybe 6 days a week. Sometimes it's really hard to see the trees from the forest. And so having, you know, a fresh perspective of someone who sees something different is hugely valuable, especially in the early stages of thinking about those micro experiments to the strategy of a business.
Have you ever been pitched by a founder who's got a great idea, maybe some great underlying technology, but you're really not convinced they're right to be, or they're the right person to be the CEO?
I probably see that a couple of times a month. It's a shame because there are some amazing ideas, but ultimately, venture is paying people to execute. Great ideas, I don't want to be really brash about it, but they're not as uncommon as people think. And it's really the executors who really deliver, and those are the people that you're backing to really grow the business. And not to say that those people who create the great ideas shouldn't be in a startup or anything like that, but it's understanding where their role is. Sometimes the great idea people are amazing product people because they care so much about the innovation. They care so much about the customer. They just get how it all works together. But that person just may not be great at fundraising. You may just not have the ability to sell. And those are some of the skills that you have to look for at the really early stage of a business, because you can't afford to have a huge sales and marketing person. You have to be able to sell to VCs, sell to customers, sell to people hiring it. And so that's where I guess often we sometimes see it, is we just don't have the conviction that person can create the right vision for the organization, but can create a great piece of tech or an idea.
So in that situation, do you turn them down flat, or do you suggest that they partner with someone who's got some complementary skills that would make them a stronger investment proposition?
Definitely. So again, going back to that early point of, it's a long-term game, you need to build relationships. I think the only way you can really do it is A, giving honest feedback, which is going to be quite tough, especially when it's about their perception on experiences and the way they've come across. But making those introductions can be hugely valuable, because if they partner with that right person, I mean, you've helped them. And when they come back for that, you know, next round or that Series A, they'll be thinking of you straight away. And so if you can partner with it and make magic work, that's a goldmine. And I'm sure there are countless stories within venture of that happening, of saying, hey, you should partner with X or Y. And then it becomes a unicorn success.
When we last spoke, you mentioned the importance of prioritization, refining your ICP and prioritizing around that ICP. So what advice do you have for startups who are struggling with issues around ICP definition?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And so that's something that I've often seen as well, is being able to understand the nuances and subtleties when speaking to customers. I think that's like hugely valuable. A lot of people will probably want your idea, but I think understanding how quickly they can move and when they want to move is really indicative of their ability. Don't get me wrong, there are bureaucracies within any organization and the larger ones, but you've got to think about, I guess, be quite selfish and think about, well, what's best for me? How can I get to my next fundraising goal or next revenue milestone so I can unlock that next piece of funding? And so I can give an example with probably one of my angel investments and then apparently one of the portfolio companies that we had as well. So one of my angel investments doing something really, really interesting within like app modernization. And when they were pitching to this competition, one large organization that I won't name, they wanted them to be on their platform within about, I think, 3 days. And historically, that for other people, I would know, would take kind of months. And so for me, that is a real strong signal of you're really solving the problem for that customer and they really see huge value for that. And so if they're taking a long time but showing interest, then it may not align with the company's strategy or the overarching goals, and you're trying to use that person to sell within that organization. And so understanding their willingness to move is, I think, a huge indicator for it, and being able to understand how it fits within their organization prior to a point. And so, again, the other example I can give was, again, an insurtech company. And I remember when we were kind of in one of the board meetings, they were like, look, we want to go after these big insurers, but it just doesn't make sense because they're just moving too slow. And so that doesn't make sense for us. And so we're going to go after this really subset niche of MGAs and target them. And so they were able to get, you know, much faster sales cycles. They were able to convert and close them. They were able to learn a lot more from them while still massaging those larger organizations. And so I think being able to prioritize, as much as these large organizations that can offer you million-pound ARRs and all sorts, if they can't move fast enough for you, then it's just not going to work at this early stage. And so you need to think about, who can I move as fast as possible to get the revenue of the line and learn from my customer experiences as well? Because they're going to tell you an indefinite thing. They're going to break your system that you don't even realize how it's going to be broken. They're going to, you know, give you so much about, they're going to really test your processes on customer success. They're going to tell you more about feedback. All that stuff's hugely valuable. And, you know, if you get them right and they're willing to pay for it, they're probably also going to champion it as well to other people. And that, I think, is a huge gold dust, especially when they really believe in the idea and they really believe in the mission. And so it compounds over time. And I think that that's the huge challenge with sometimes startups is everyone's saying yes, but it's how loudly are they saying yes? And I think being able to determine that is part of the challenge of the early stage startup is what we see. And some of them, unfortunately, kind of just get paralysis and just can't be able to diffuse, focus on which one and really delivering something great for that.
And sticking with the topic of prioritization, how do you and your colleagues in the early stage ventures team, how do you prioritize across your portfolio? The typical ratios are maybe 1 in 10 or perhaps 2 in 10 portfolio companies will hit it out of the park. The rest will be a mixture of lowish returns or even outright failure. So how do you allocate and prioritize your time across the portfolio?
It's a really good question. So every VC's dream is to invest in a company that doesn't need their VC money. If I'm being very frank, it doesn't need their help. Because those are the points where you knock it out of the park, you've got to do very little work, and you probably make a lot of money and hopefully buy a jet ski or some an island in the middle of nowhere. And so some of the Mercia portfolio, I mean, that's happened. And that's been some examples, especially with some of the investment directors. They've just knocked it out of the park. It just doesn't make sense for us as investors who probably invest in seed to series B. They probably don't need our time and support. Happy to always have updates and support them as of when. And, you know, when it comes to this important discussions, get involved, but you can kind of take a foot off the back pedal. And especially if there's another investor in the round who can support them in future rounds that we can't, it just doesn't make sense for us to take up more of their time. There's so many other nuances that get involved in that discussion, but broadly how I think about it. So the ones that knock it out of the park and hit the great gates running, as much as you want to get involved and be part of a success story, the probably right thing to do is maybe step back and really help allow them to keep on executing and support them from the sidelines, spend less of your time. The ones, I guess, that are failing and kind of, you know, aren't working. Okay, well, what can we do to understand what happened, why I get wrong? Do we feel like the fundamentals of the business just didn't work? Or is there something a bit more ongoing? Do we need to get a bit more involved with that? And so you probably spend a lot of your time between those sort of companies and probably those in the middle who are doing okay, but you know, may need a bit more handholding, may need further investment, may need a bridge round, may need to help them with the, you know, fundraise of the next bit. It's all that kind of, it's constant firefighting. And that's what someone told me at Simvan when I joined is, I remember the partner said, it's like, you sure you want to still be here? And I was like, yeah, I know, I really enjoy it. It's like, you realize you're just constantly putting out fires every single day. And even at Mercia, while the, again, very different kind of portfolio, that's, I think, where I see some of my colleagues doing is, okay, how can we resolve these fires? Do we still believe there is this, you know, 10, 15x opportunity? And if there is, then we need to resolve these fires and help and support the founders.
You mentioned that you love reading. So what are the three books you'd recommend for anyone interested in VC, startups, and technology?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And so early on, I'd probably give, you know, a list of like nonfiction books, Venture Deals, Learning Like Chip War, and you know, all things that give geopolitical risk, you know, reading some biographies like Shoe Dog, et cetera, and, you know, Zero to One and Lean Startup. All those really good books. And I do think they add a huge amount of value for it. But I think going back to that really early point about, I think great people in venture, especially, are people who provide different perspectives. It's very easy to point out why a startup would fail or will fail, because about 90% of them do. I think what it takes real guts in ventures is to be able to point out why a startup succeeds. And I think to be able to highlight why a startup succeeds is, and being able to spot it is really having a different view and different point of perspective. And so I'm a big believer in going down rabbit holes, broadening your perspective. And so a lot of books I've been reading now, I've been really focused around that, you know, fiction title. So I read Brothers of Karamazov, which took me a very long time, read Master and Margarita. And they're a lot more like philosophical books, but they're more about human nature. And I think that becomes hugely important in venture, of understanding people's motives, understanding, you know, why people do what they do, and having a broader view of world, and having, instead of just reading books from kind of English author, reading different books, different perspectives on how people see the world. So you come in with a much more richer view of things. So that would be it. I would say don't constantly read nonfiction books, but do give yourself a good understanding, but keep on reading stuff that you enjoy, because that's going to give you a different perspective intervention. That's definitely what the industry needs.
So one book that you think might open my mind a bit more, give me more of a broader perspective, fiction or nonfiction, what should I be reading?
I'm actually a huge fan of Nicholas Taleb, and I think like Black Swan, I think is a great book.
Good shout out. Okay, that's cool. It's been a wide-ranging discussion. Thank you so much for joining me on the first nice sunny day of 2024. Thanks, Amrit.
No, it was a pleasure for being on the podcast. Thanks for having me, Gary.
This episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan was brought to you by Alpina Search. Head over to www.alpinasearch.com for advice on scaling your technology startup and recruiting high-impact senior talent.